And I understand that this is a PG year. I get it. But we in New York City, baby! And if you ain't down the dirt, we got two bullets for you!
Happy New Year, everybody. This is episode 252 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off here on SEScoops.com, year-end edition for Sunday, December 30th, 2012. I am the Solo Monster. That little clip you heard there at the beginning of the show was taken from the WWE Holiday Tour house show at Madison Square Garden here in New York City this past Thursday night, an event that I was at along with Webmaster Mike and Brian Blade. And I'm going to have an exclusive report on that show here this week. We'll talk about the Christmas Eve edition of Raw. I've got some thoughts on that. And Impact Wrestling from this past Thursday night. So you know, there are going to be, well, let's just say there's going to be a lot of sound off this weekend. This is the first of two brand new episodes that are on tap. Today, of course, episode 252. Tomorrow, being New Year's Eve, episode 253, which I guess will officially be the final sound off of the year, will be going up. And that will be dedicated to a year-in-review look both at WWE and TNA, as well as a look forward. We'll have some predictions. Usually we do a year-in-review roundup. This time we're going to do it a little bit differently, and that we'll have some predictions for WWE and TNA for the new year. So I'll dedicate an entire show to that. That should be up by tomorrow. And also, for the benefit of those of you who have not been following along on Twitter and Facebook, I've gotten back to posting some old episodes of The Sound Off from yesteryear, the so-called lost episodes. Many of the first 40 or so shows, which were once up, obviously, many years ago, are nowhere to be found. You can find old episodes of The Sound Off going all the way back to 43 if you look hard enough online, but the ones that predate that have since gone to the wayside. So what I've been doing over the last several months, sporadically, is posting some of those vintage Sound Offs from the very beginning, 2007, 2008, on my YouTube channel. My username on there is The Solemn Monster, all one word. You can subscribe to my YouTube channel there. I posted two brand new vintage Sound Offs last weekend, episodes 4 and 5. So if you've never heard those before, you can go back and take a listen. And there will be another new, old episode, I guess you would say, coming up on New Year's Day. So this upcoming Tuesday, January 1st, the first day of 2013, I will be posting episode number 6 of the Solo Monster Sounds Off from way back when on December 9th, 2007. So if you want to listen to some of those old episodes, YouTube is the only place to do it. I'm not uploading them to iTunes, I should say. I just created a new service. Not uploading them to iTunes. They are exclusive to the YouTube channel, so you could check them out there. And leave some comments, likes, dislikes, whatever you feel like doing. So I just wanted to make mention of that. So let's start things off here. I just want to talk first about the Madison Square Garden show, part of the WWE Holiday Tour. I believe they used to have a holiday tour called the Holiday Hell Tour, but of course it's PG now. You can't say Holiday Hell. So we got to the Garden on Thursday night, pretty packed, but far from sold out. Plenty of empty seats around. In fact, in the section that we were in, which was way up, section 224, practically nobody in our section, which was great. We enjoyed that part of it. It was nice to have some space. But nonetheless, I mean, still a lot of people there, a lot of kids, as you would probably imagine. Anybody who's been to a WWE show recently would probably say the same thing. A lot of kids with their parents. And interestingly enough, as we came into the arena where they have the merchandise on sale, and we went over, and they actually were selling John Cena Rally Monkeys for $20. And the first thought that I had to myself is, of all the people on the WWE roster that you would think would need a rally monkey, John Cena is not the first person that comes to mind. So I thought that was kind of ironic. And I did not spend $20 on the John Cena rally monkey, although Webmaster Mike did buy a shirt. So that's some money in CM Punk's pocket right there. So, like I said, pretty packed, lively crowd. They aired the WWE Jingle Bells holiday video, which they also aired before Raw this past Monday night. They aired that video multiple times throughout the night. Webmaster Mike grew more and more disgusted each time they aired this, and he had to listen to them talking about entertaining us. If you go back and listen to the video, they don't talk about going out there and wrestling or fighting or anything. They're there to entertain. It's not wrestling, entertaining. And this made this almost made Webmaster Mike violently ill. In fact, he is actually sick now, and I wonder maybe if this video made him sick. So anyway, Vicky Guerrero was there. She opened the show. Massive heat. I mean, she is still a heat magnet. I mean, I think her peak was probably as the SmackDown general manager. That was the peak of her, I guess I can't say popularity, really. But even today, she still is a heat magnet. So anybody wondering why they keep her around, oh, she's terrible and this and that, that's why. Because she still gets an unbelievable reaction, probably more than most heels do on the roster. She ran down the main matches for us. First up were the New Age Outlaws, who beat the Rhodes Scholars, Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow. Perfectly fine 10-minute match. Nothing wrong with it at all. Road Dogg came out, did his usual spiel. I've seen reports on different wrestling websites that kind of differ. Some people say the Outlaws were really over. Other reports say that they, you know, the crowd was kind of quiet. I'm not sure what event those people went to, but I can tell you even from all the way up where we were sitting, they got a very big reaction from the crowd when they came out. People were very happy to see them. And they knew, you know, the Road Dogg sing-along and the whole nine yards. Billy Gunn got on the mic, as you heard in that clip I played at the beginning. He said he knows it's a PG product now. And everybody booed, which I thought was hilarious. Even the kids were booing. And the other funny thing about that, and I didn't realize this until I went back and watched the video that I shot on my iPhone. But when Billy said that, when he mentioned that, you know, it's a PG product now and everybody booed, you know, Sandow and Rose were on the outside of the ring because they had already come out. And Damian Sandow, when Billy Gunn mentioned that it's a PG product, now Sandow just started clapping furiously. He was very happy about the fact that it's now a PG product. So if there's one person on the roster that does like the new PG product, it's Damian Sandow. But anyway, Billy Gunn said, you know, to hell with that. It's New York City. And everybody chanted, suck it. They were very happy. The Outlaws easily could have another run in them. I think all three of us at the show agreed. What we saw in this match, you know, they didn't look slow or, you know, tired or out of place or out of shape or anything like that. WWE could very easily, if they wanted to, bring the Outlaws back to TV. They don't have to be, you know, full-time wrestling every week. I don't think that's the right way to use them. But if you want to mix them into the tag division, they've done a very good job of trying to make the tag team division mean something. You know, bringing the New Age Outlaws in, former five-time tag champions, very popular, very over, they could work with some of these teams like the Rhodes Scholars and like the Primetime Players, or even any new guys they may bring up from developmental over the next couple of months. I was going to say the Ascension, although I guess that tag team now is dead. But do they have another run of them? Could they hold the belts again? Absolutely. Absolutely. I would not doubt that for a second, and we may well end up seeing that. But the only reason they were on this show, apparently they were a replacement for Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara, and I didn't see anybody complaining about that. So thumbs up on that. That was very enjoyable. We had Brodus Clay beating David Otunga. Otunga posed before the match. They dimmed the lights. He posed to some wacky music like Chris Masters used to do. And after the match, Jack Swagger returned. Haven't seen him on television in many months. And he came back doing the exact same gimmick he was doing before the last time we saw him on TV. And that includes the losing part, by the way. He got beat by Brodus Clay in maybe 2 minutes, if that. So, look, it's a house show, as I believe Brian Blade said to me, because I was very upset by this, the fact that Jack Swagger is back and nothing has changed. And perhaps, as Brian suggested, it's a house show. You know, maybe it doesn't mean anything. He'll be back on TV soon. Maybe he'll, you know, be a babyface, as I suggested he should be, or something else. But from the looks of it, nothing has changed. He'll be back on TV soon. And I don't know what to say. You know, same old Jack Swagger. Eve pinned Caitlyn to retain her Divas Championship. This was the house show debut of the infamous Divas stopwatch, which clocked this match at a whopping 6 minutes, 25 seconds. It's pretty impressive. On Twitter, I wrote that Eve retained her title, only I wrote titty for some reason instead of title, and did not realize my typo until over an hour later. So yes, Eve retained her titty and her title. Santino Pintenzai, total comedy match. Before the match, Justin Roberts got on the horn. He announced a Twitter poll. Yes, a Twitter poll on a house show. And they even had the percentages up on the little Minitron above the ring, kept calculating and changing as though they were actually keeping track of these results. I called bullshit on that. Anyway, he said the loser of this next match would be forced to sing a song in The options were Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer or Jingle Bells. Rudolph won, and so poor Tenzai had to sing for us. And, you know, we were talking about this during the show. He didn't want to do it. Tenzai did not want to sing, and Vicky Guerrero came out. She threatened to fire him if he did not sing. And you wonder if Tenzai, a part of him, wouldn't have just loved to say, fuck it, fire me, and then get on the first flight back to Japan. But he didn't do that. And not for nothing, I thought this was rather entertaining. He sang a few bars from Adam Sandler's Hanukkah song. And he claimed that he was Jewish. This is a revelation here. He claimed that he was Jewish. He may well be. I just never thought of Tenzai as being Jewish. But he claimed that he was Jewish, as well as Paul Heyman, which we all know. And Justin Roberts, apparently, was outed, as Brian Blade said. And we also joked that this could be his new gimmick, the Jewish-Japanese samurai. Hey, it could get over. Then he sang Rudolph. He did a pretty decent job, all things considered. I was impressed. And my fear is that Vince McMahon is going to hear about this, because I doubt he was actually at the show. But he'll hear about this, and they'll end up giving Trevor Murdoch's old singing gimmick to Tenzai. But I enjoyed this for what it was. The Shield beat Miz, Kane, and Daniel Bryan, with Roman Reigns pinning Miz, thank God. Shield did their entrance through the crowd, which was cool. It must have been a big thrill for them to be making their debut at Madison Square Garden. This was probably the second best match of the entire show. I really do enjoy these Shield matches, even though I've only seen two of them. I understand it's a small sample size, but I do enjoy these six-man tags that they're in. After intermission, the Usos beat the Primetime Players. This was the one match I missed. I was still waiting in line for food. Thankfully, these concession stand workers at the Garden actually know what they're doing, unlike that one woman over at the Izod Center. The great Antonio Cesaro, also making his Madison Square Garden debut, beat Zack Ryder to retain the United States Championship. Cesaro did one of those uppercuts to the back of the head that he does, which was disappointing, because I like those out-of-nowhere uppercuts that he does. You can call them a supercut, actually. That's a great name for it. When he does those unbelievable uppercuts, you know, like when Sheamus came off the top rope on Raw that one time and he nailed him with it, they should call it the supercut. That's not a bad name. But there was no uppercut of death on this show, unfortunately. He beat Zach with a neutralizer. Pretty boring match, actually, most of the way. It picked up a lot the last couple of minutes, a lot of near falls. Really good at the end, actually, so that saved it. Then we had our co-main event, Pretty Paul Heyman, as I have dubbed him. He was out next for his street fight against Ryback. In light of CM Punk's knee injury, Paul Heyman was the replacement for the WWE Champion. He came out wearing a black sweatshirt, black sweatpants, no music, no ECW chants either, which I found shocking. No real reaction for Paul Heyman at all, which tells you how many little kids there were in the audience with their parents. It's just a different crowd now. You know, it's 2012, almost 2013, and it's just, you know, I guess those times are over. Heyman got on the mic, talked about how he used to snap photos at ringside back in the day, which reminds me, my good friend George Napolitano was at ringside shooting photos for the event. I think he was the only one down there, in fact, taking pictures. You may recall I interviewed George, perhaps the most prolific wrestling photographer of all time. I interviewed him back on Sound Off 182, and I asked him about Heyman back when Paul used to annoy all the other photographers by getting in the way of their shots. And they all tried to have him banned from ringside at one point, but George stuck up for him and became friends with Paul Heyman. And anyway, it was good to see him at the show. Heyman mentioned all the great names that have wrestled in the Garden, from superstar Billy Graham to Bruno Sammartino, who got a nice reaction, to Hulk Hogan, who got a lot of boos, actually. He mentioned The Rock, and then he mentioned Stone Cold Steve Austin, who got a massive reaction from the crowd, which was nice to see. Easily the biggest of all the names that Paul mentioned. And Heyman said they could all kiss his ass, so showing complete disrespect to the champions from the past. Ryback came out. Paul Heyman ran away. The Shield came out to attack Ryback. They brought a table into the ring. They propped it up in the corner. This brought out Miz, Kane, and Daniel Bryan again. They evened out the odds, brawled with the Shield to the back. And this left Ryback flat on his back. Paul Heyman very cautiously tippy-toeing towards him like a little snake. And unfortunately for him, Ryback got up, picked him up, gave him the shell shock, and pinned him. 1, 2, 3, and that was that. Really not even much of a match. He went to leave. He realized there was still a table in the ring that had not been broken. which for a pro wrestler is like an alarm bell going off. You know, if there's an unbroken piece of furniture, it must be destroyed before you can leave. So he went back, picked up Paul Heyman, ran full steam into the corner, and put Heyman through the table. Heyman laid there for like a full 10 minutes afterwards, just sold it like he was dead. And I was hoping he wasn't having another heart attack, which thankfully he did not. Main event was a steel cage match. Dolph Ziggler came out with AJ Lee and Big E Langston. John Cena came out, much to the delight of all the little kiddies. I don't know what happened, but I'm pretty sure before the match, Justin Roberts made an announcement. He said the only way to win was by escaping over the cage or through the door. And yet, 2 minutes into this match, John Cena went for a pin, and the referee refused to count. So Cena then walks over to the side of the cage. He starts talking to somebody on the outside. And lo and behold, after all, the referee started counting pin attempts after that. So somebody must have fucked up on that one. Match was really, really good. Went about 20 minutes long. Best match of the night. There was a ref bump. Langston interfered. He attacked Cena for a really good near fall. AJ came into the cage. She had one of her freakouts. Then she slapped Cena hard across the face. We could hear that slap from all the way up where we were, too. So that was a hard slap. Now, if this were 10 years ago, Little Miss AJ would have earned herself an attitude adjustment. But this is PG, so Cena responded by kissing her on the lips. And the only thing I could think of is, God, that girl's mouth must be like a Petri dish by now. Langston interfered again. He held Cena for Ziggler. Cena ducked. Ziggler destroyed Langston with a super kick. Just brutal stuff. And Cena gives Ziggler the attitude adjustment. 1, 2, 3. All the little kiddies rejoice as the show ends with John Cena's music playing. I don't think anybody expected any different. And that was the show. It was a fun show. I'm glad I went. I had not been to a house show in, God, I don't even know. I mean, the last one I remember being at would have been 1998. Yeah, I think it may have been that long. And I also had the pleasure of meeting one of our listeners, Antonio from the Bronx. It was his first live event in 10 years, and the first for his young son, so that must have been a great experience for him. A very chance meeting Antonio and I had. He spotted me in the parking garage after the show with Brian Blade, so that was very cool. And they also announced a presale for the WWE Hall of Fame 2013 ceremony. And I am happy to report that I will be in attendance at MSG for my second Hall of Fame ceremony next year, along with the rest of the SC Scoops gang. We're all going. And I believe they're doing more renovations to the Garden next summer, so there may not be any live events at the Garden until after the Hall of Fame next year, which may well be next year's post-Christmas tour. It could be another year before we actually have another WWE event at the Garden. So the first round of renovations they did to the building are very nice, but I can't help but feel like it's kind of stripped away some of the Garden's identity, namely that short aisleway that I used to love so much. It's gone now. It's not there anymore, and that's a shame. But otherwise, you know, looks very nice. I think one part of the arena, I was told, they have some WrestleMania 1 stuff up on the wall, almost like I don't want to say a tribute to WrestleMania 1. I guess it kind of is. We weren't on that side of the building, so we didn't see it. But it looks nice. Monday Night Raw, the Christmas Eve edition, taped in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania a few weeks ago. Webmaster Mike is in town, and so he and I were actually out on Christmas Eve, and I did not have a chance to watch Raw until the next day. And when I asked you guys on Twitter how the show was, I don't think I've ever gotten such a universally negative response to an episode of Raw, which is saying a lot. I figured, you know, when I saw that, I figured, well, it can't possibly be as bad as everybody is saying it is. So maybe I'll actually, you know, be pleasantly surprised. Perhaps the show will exceed my expectations, which I admit were pretty low going in. And I watched the first 10 minutes or so, and I thought that I had accidentally hit play on the DVR for Saturday Morning Slam. That's really what this show was. It was a 3-hour edition of Saturday Morning Slam. I had people write me and tell me they hated it, but their kids loved it. And I could see that. You know, I could see kids really liking this show. I mean, you know, this show was designed, clearly, with kids in mind. And it was still a gigantic waste of time. You know, the premise of the show was Santa Foley, Mick Foley, dressed up as Santa Claus, came out to deliver presents to all the little boys and girls in the crowd when he was run over by the evil aristocrat, Alberto Del Rio. He pulled a Rikishi, and he ran down Santa. And really, what a pussy this makes Stone Cold Steve Austin look like for being hit by a car and taking 10 months off when it only took 3 hours for Santa Claus to recover. But yeah, Del Rio ran over Santa. This was the show-long storyline here. And now, you may be asking, didn't Alberto Del Rio just turn babyface? Why would he be booked as such a villain on this show? And you know what? I don't have an answer for you. Apparently, when the show went off the air, Del Rio turned back babyface again, but they decided not to air that part on TV, so I have no clue what's going on here, but I think it's safe to say that WWE has managed to book two of the worst babyface turns in the history of all mankind, all in the span of 2 months, that, of course, being Alberto Del Rio and The Miz. So this was one of those shows where, about midway through, I honestly thought it was going to be revealed in the end that it was like a dream sequence. You know, remember that one skit they did a couple years ago where Vince McMahon woke up and it was all just a dream? You know, he had all the election stickers on, and this was after Linda lost, I think, the first time. I thought for sure that Vince would wake up in a cold sweat and we would just be told that none of this ever happened. But nope. This actually did happen. Michael Cole and Jerry Lawler, they had to play this up as real. Santa Claus was real. And he was really in bad shape. He really may not survive. We had medical updates on Santa's condition throughout the show. So grave was Santa's condition at one point, they didn't think he'd make it. You know, maybe he would have been better off, you know, going to a hospital instead of laying there dying in the trainer's room backstage. I will say this. Everyone involved in this show clearly knew what it was, and nobody was taking it seriously. It was just done for fun. You know, nobody was watching the show on Christmas Eve. I mean, hell, even I didn't watch the show on Christmas Eve. But I hate, as many of you know who listen to this show, I hate when they overdo comedy on Raw. Especially with the main event guys. That just, I mean, it's a huge pet peeve of mine when they do that. And essentially what we had here was not just one or two comedy segments. We had an entire three-hour show that was basically one giant comedy skit. And that's fine, I guess, because it was Christmas and they can just go into Royal Rumble hype mode, you know, this week or next week. But I thought this sucked. You can disagree. You can think that, you know, hey, it was just a lighthearted show. But you know what? It was 3 hours of my life that I can never have back. And I just, this was too hokey even for me. You know, wrestling is supposed to be hokey. It's supposed to be, to some degree, over the top. I mean, look at the characters, for God's sake, that we've had over the years. I get that. But this was too much even for me. Now, there were some good aspects to the show. I didn't hate the show from start to finish. There actually were parts of the show that I liked. You know, this was not the worst Raw in history, as some of you emailed me and said it was. You know, again, the show didn't take itself seriously. It was what it was meant to be. For one thing, I'm really happy they kept the Shield far, far away from all of this silliness. You know, they did not have to be on the show this week, and they weren't, and that was a smart move. I don't think I could have taken the sight of Roman Reigns running around in a Santa hat, so thank God we didn't have to, you know, deal with that. The other thing I really liked was that 12-man tag team match with the Primetime Players, 3-man band, and Tenzai. Against the Usos, Justin Gabriel, Tyson Kidd, Santino, and Brodus Clay. Yes, it was the Jobber Brigade, but you know what? Some of those guys are really underutilized, like Kidd and Gabriel, and the Usos come to mind. And so it was nice to see them get some decent ring time on Raw for a change. You know, even the women got some time this week. There was an 8-Diva tag team match on this show. It was not particularly good at all. But I clocked it at 5 minutes 28 seconds on the Diva stopwatch, which for TV may as well be an Iron Man match. You know, it's one thing for Eve and Caitlyn to go 6 minutes on a house show, but for the women to get 5.5 minutes on TV is amazing. And the other thing I wanted to mention about the Divas match, Rosa Mendez has absolutely no business whatsoever being inside a wrestling ring. She is terrible. Terrible! It's almost as though she's regressing as a performer. You would think, you know, she's been around now for a couple of years, used to be in developmental, she's been on TV for some time now. You'd think that people would progress, but she somehow is regressing. She's getting worse as time goes on. She just looks like she has absolutely no idea what she's doing when she's in there. And she was by far the worst part of that match. She is awful. Awful. So I just have to point that out. So after the opening of the show with Santa getting killed, we got a backstage segment where Booker T gave a grim prognosis for old Saint Nick. And this is when he made the main event, which was a Miracle on 34th Street fight between Alberto Del Rio and John Cena, who was more obnoxious in this one backstage segment than I can't even put into words how irritating Cena was in this segment. This was everything I despise about the John Cena character on display right here. One of our listeners actually said he was smoking some medical marijuana while watching this, and he had a good laugh, and it actually pissed me off because I might have actually enjoyed this more with some liquor, but I had drank enough the night before, so I was not doing that again. Kane beat Cody Rhodes. Actually, I think all the baby faces went over on this show now that I think about it. We got Jerry Lawler's annual Christmas Creature reference for Kane, which is always fun. For those of you who don't know, Kane had a stint early in his career in the old USWA as this thing called the Christmas Creature. He was basically decorated like a gigantic Christmas tree, I guess. He had ornaments on him and very green. I think he only had a few matches, and then he got fed to Jerry Lawler. As, you know, all the big heels they would bring in back then used to be fed to Jerry Lawler. Jerry Lawler was the big baby face in that territory. And he got fed to Lawler, and that was the end of that. And Lawler will always make sure on these shows that we never forget the Christmas Creature. So he did not disappoint this year. Sheamus pinned Big Show in a non-title Lumberjack Frost match. How clever. This show meant nothing, so Sheamus won clean with a bro kick. You know what, I take that back. At least Sheamus beating Big Show here in a non-title match makes sense if the purpose is to set up Sheamus getting another shot at the world title. You know, if that's how they end up explaining it, then it makes sense. Because otherwise, like I said last week on the Sound Off, explain to me why Sheamus deserves another title shot after his loss at TLC. So, if that's why they did this, I actually approve of that. Because now we have a legitimate reason for Sheamus to say, listen, I just beat Big Show fair and square. I pinned him last week. I deserve another title shot. Not that I want to necessarily see them, you know, have 18 million title matches, but at least that would make sense. And all of the Lumberjacks, by the way, had to wear Santa hats, so they all looked like fools. In case you didn't already know, this was a kid's show. They re-aired the Miz TV segment from Tribute to the Troops, which I went out of my way not to watch, just so I didn't have to see that segment. And so naturally, they aired it again here with Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy. David Otunga came out. He said some bullshit. Zack Ryder interrupted him. They had a match. Zack won. On the show, that means nothing, of course. Zack Ryder won a match. You know, 1 year ago, he beat Dolph Ziggler on pay-per-view to become the United States champion. And now he's beating David Otunga on the holiday show. So, Merry Christmas, Zack. I like Brad Maddox. It just felt like saying that. Brad Maddox was on this show. I don't know what it is about the guy, but I like him. Booker T told him that he could have a contract if he wins his match against one of Santa's elves, who turned out to be the Great Khali, who, by the way, won a 20-man battle royal on Main Event this week to earn himself a U.S. title match with Antonio Cesaro, I believe this upcoming Wednesday, on this week's edition of Main Event. And if Cesaro can get Khali up for the neutralizer, I will do the Sound Off next week in a Swiss accent. In other words, it ain't going to happen. But Khali on this show pinned Brad Maddox, then he sang a Christmas song that I could barely understand. But he seemed happy, so that's cool. Miz and Kofi Kingston beat Antonio Cesaro and Wade Barrett after Miz pinned Barrett, which just does not seem right at all to me. Have a little bit of a spoiler alert here for Raw this upcoming week, which was taped on Saturday night, the Raw that will air on Christmas Eve. So if you don't want to hear a spoiler, skip ahead by 20 or 30 seconds, although this is not really much of a spoiler because it's right on the front page of WWE.com, so they spoiled their own fucking show, so not really a spoiler. Wade Barrett beat Kofi Kingston at the TV tapings to win the Intercontinental Championship, and that title change will air on Raw this Monday night. So I guess it makes sense that they've been beating him like a drum lately. That's their MO. You know, you beat a guy left and right and then put the title on him. I don't agree with that, but that's how they do things. CM Punk and Paul Heyman came to the ring. Punk made a reference to Hanukkah, which just warmed my soul. I think he turned to look at Heyman when he did it, which just made it that much better. He basically just ran down the fans, as he does every week. Heyman threatened to sue Ryback if he laid a finger on CM Punk. This brought Ryback out to the ring. And Ryback said that he would face Punk for the title on January 7th in a tables, ladders, and chairs match, which was the original match. It was supposed to be a TLC match at the pay-per-view. And so I guess they're going to stick with the stipulation. And Ryback got the crowd to chant TLC, and that was that. Daniel Bryan beat Damian Sandow with the no-lock. And then we had the 12-man tag, which I enjoyed. Excuse me. Backstage, Kane gave Daniel Bryan a Slammy Award for Christmas. Bryan was very excited. I thought that Daniel Bryan had won a Slammy Award, you know, the WWE.com ones that they had announced on online, but I guess not. So Bryan was very excited about this, and in return, he also had gotten Kane a Christmas gift. He got Kane a puppy, which appeared to be dressed in a sweater. And Kane thanked him, and he said he was starving. And I didn't know Kane was Korean, but I guess he is. And this made Bryan very angry. He grabbed the dog back. He said, "Animals are our friend, not food." And Bryan Blade would agree. For me, a world without chicken and bacon is not a world that I care to live in. But that's just me personally. They had segments throughout the show with Dolph Ziggler and AJ Lee celebrating Christmas together. There was great sexual tension between them. They ended up making out under the mistletoe. They knocked over a Christmas tree in the process. You know, given what Amy Schumer said about her little romp in the sack with Dolph Ziggler, and given how unstable AJ is, like a real wild girl, I can only imagine what a sex tape with the two of them would look like. I think I'd rather watch that than the Hogan sex tape. I think that's for damn sure. Main event was a Miracle on 34th streak fight between Cena and Del Rio. Match was total cheese. Just, you know, it was what it was. It was fine. They had gift boxes littered all over the ringside area. Cena pulled a steel chair out of one gift box. That's a pretty shitty Christmas gift to get, but he used the steel chair on Del Rio. I was amused by Del Rio's reaction when Ricardo opened one of the gifts and handed him a pie to throw at John Cena. Del Rio's reaction to this was actually quite comical. And then later, Ricardo gave Del Rio a teddy bear, which he did throw at John Cena. He did, in fact, try to use the teddy bear as a weapon. Cena no-sold it. I did laugh at this. I thought this was genuinely funny. Cena threw a tree at Del Rio at one point. The fans chanted, "Use the tree," which he did. I was hoping the tree would be wrapped in barbed wire. Sadly, it was not. And the finish came with Ricardo putting Cena in a sleeper hold. And Cena was about to go out when, all of a sudden, Santa's music hit. It's a Christmas miracle. Santa Foley comes out looking pretty good for a guy they told us was being read his last rites about 20 minutes earlier. Ricardo was very excited about this. He ran down the aisle and Santa hit him with his giant sack. And then Santa put a stocking on his hand and gave Del Rio the mandible claw. Cena picked him up, dropped him with the AA and got the pin. The fans rejoiced. I rejoiced because this meant the show was over. And that, my friends, as I said earlier, is 3 hours of my life that I can never, ever have back. So there you go. That's the Christmas Eve edition of Raw. Let's not speak of that ever again. I caught Impact Wrestling, of course, Thursday night. As I mentioned, we were at Madison Square Garden. I did not get to see Impact until yesterday. I first watched Impact. I really wanted to see it. I just had to see the final Impact of 2012. Even though it was taped a few weeks ago, I didn't read any of the spoilers. And I'm glad I watched it, because you know what? It was a damn good show. I enjoyed it. It was much better than Raw this week. So if you haven't checked out Impact, you might want to give it a look. It was open fight night, which I'm not a fan of, but in spite of this, I thought it was a good show. There were some interesting things. You know, the show opened with Bully Ray coming out. And Bully Ray is in the middle of this whole thing with Hulk Hogan. You know, Hulk Hogan does not trust Bully Ray, as well he should not, because, as I have said over and over again, I do believe Bully Ray is in cahoots in some way with Aces and Eights, and perhaps is trying to convert Hulk's daughter to the dark side. But anyway, Hogan was not on this show. For a change, they actually left Hulk off the show, which I think they should do more often. Hulk Hogan should be special. You know, he should be a special attraction. I happen to think that Hulk Hogan, in his current role as the general manager of Impact, is actually very good. I think it's the best role that Hulk can have on the show. But he doesn't have to be on television every single week. And so he did not come out. Bully Ray said, as part of Open Fight Night, he was challenging Hogan to come out, not to wrestle, but to talk. Which, word of advice to any wrestlers out there, if they are listening, if you're ever doing a promo in front of an audience that is probably there to see action, don't go out of your way to say, listen, I challenge you to come out, not to wrestle, but to talk. Because the fans did not like this. They booed this, in fact. And Brooke Hogan came out. You know, they did this deal where it's like, you know, she didn't have a microphone, but you could hear what she was saying. And she was like, oh, my dad's not here. He knows. He knows. And Bully Ray's like, well, what does he know? There's nothing to know. And she's like, I don't know how he knows, but he knows. He knows that we were together. And this was so stupid. This was just so dumb because, listen, again, wrestling, over the top, I get that. Suspension of disbelief, absolutely. But how dumb does Brooke Hogan and Bully Ray, how dumb do they have to be when Hogan knows because the end of Impact last week on television aired a segment where Hogan was leaving the building and saw his daughter and Bully Ray in the parking garage making out. And in the last 7 days since that occurred, nobody has told them or showed them footage to prove that, in fact, the reason Hulk knows is because, hey, dipshit, it aired on television. It just makes the baby faces in this case look so stupid. And WWE has done the same thing before. It's so dumb. Just acknowledge the fact that it was on television, but you don't know who filmed it. How about that? You know, it was probably just one of the dumb production idiots who chases everybody around backstage, but you know, why, that at least would be more believable. You know, it aired on TV. Everybody saw it. Everybody knows, but I don't know who did it. I don't know who was behind it. That at least would be more believable. But, yeah, these two came off like a couple of dumb shits on this show. They had a segment on Impact, which I thought I would hate. I will admit that going in. I almost fast-forwarded through it on the DVR. I almost didn't even watch it. But I did watch it, and I'm happy I did, because perhaps my favorite segment, or one of my favorite segments, believe it or not, on the show, was the bro-off. They had a total comedy segment here. It was Robbie E. and Robbie T. There was a backstage segment earlier on Impact, where basically they bumped into Jesse Godders backstage, who was Tara's boyfriend, okay? So they bump into Jesse, and Jesse is this California guy. He says, you know, dude, at the end of everything, and Robbie E. says bro, so we got a lot of bros and a lot of dudes, and it's Open Fight Night, so Robbie E. said, listen, instead of having a match, let's have a bro-off. So we had the bro-off. They came out. The rules were very simple. Robbie E. told Jesse and Tara that we're going to have a bit of a dance-off here, and then you're going to say something, and whatever you say, it has to end in bro. So Robbie E. proceeds to do this horrific dance, which I think he's been doing this on the house shows for a long time. I don't know that he's ever did this on television, but like when I went to the TNA Base Brawl show in Brooklyn in July or August, whenever it was, he did this dance, just this horrific dance. And then he said something, and it ended in bro, and then Jesse didn't dance. He did a pose down. So basically, you know, he did what David Otunga did on the Madison Square Garden house show, only he did a much better job, I will say, than Otunga did. And a very impressive physical specimen is this Jesse. And then he got on the mic and he said something and ended it with, dude. So Robbie said, listen, you're automatically disqualified because you used the word bro. Or rather, I should say, used the word dude. You have to end in bro, which means I win. Plus, during Jesse's performance, he pressed Tara over his head, which was very impressive. And Robbie E. said, listen, in this contest, it's bros, not hoes, which I thought was a funny line. So he declared himself the winner, but then Robbie T. grabbed the microphone out of his hand and said, oh, there's one more bro here. And then Robbie T. proceeded to do some poses himself, also very, you know, physically impressive. And he did, I don't know what this guy did. It was like he was on some sort of acid trip or something. He did like a back roll and it was something else, I have to say. And Robbie E. and Jesse had these gobsmacked looks on their faces. Their jaws were wide open. I laughed at this. I thought this was really entertaining, actually. And much better than any of the so-called comedy we got on Raw Monday night. And the best part about this, it was kept to one segment. See? Didn't stretch out for the entire show. It was one segment, and it was done. That's how I like my comedy. One and done. RVD came out to issue a challenge as part of Open Fight Night, and he cut a horrific promo. RVD, it was clearly some scripted stuff for him, and RVD just does not do very well with this material. It just sounds completely unnatural coming from his mouth. He challenged Christian York, and so they had a match. Pretty good match, you know, nothing special, but it was fine for what it was. We also on this show, which if it wasn't my favorite thing, it was my second favorite thing behind the bro-off, had an awesome Joe Park OVW package. It had some highlights and clips from some of the recent training sessions of his that they've aired, with some newer comments mixed in, like him commenting on how tough it's been, you know, how difficult it's been to learn a lot of the maneuvers and how he thinks he's coming along and, you know, he's kind of learning the trade. He had a great line here. He talked about his, he talked about there being a long line of great wrestlers in his family. And he mentioned, you know, of course, his brother, you know, Chris Abyss. And he mentioned that his great-great-grandfather, Jebediah Park, you know, had fought George Hackenschmidt once upon a time in a bare-knuckle fight. And I personally have never seen a record of that, but I'll take him at his word. But this was great. And then they had footage of Danny Davis, who, of course, is the head guy down there in OVW. A disciplinarian in these segments. Very hard-nosed. But talks about last week when they showed Joe Park getting busted open. Remember when he got popped in the nose by one of the other students and he saw his own blood and just lost it. Just lost his shit. Went crazy. Gave the guy a black hole slam. He was channeling his brother. And Danny Davis talked about that and said, yeah, I don't know where that came from, but we got to see more of that. We got to see more of that fire. And I just thought this segment was great. Joe Park is my favorite character in any wrestling organization anywhere of 2012. And just great stuff. Christopher Daniels called out AJ Styles as part of Open Fight Night, which is interesting given that they just had what we were told was their final ever match. And Daniels even mentioned that. And said that, I think he said something like, you know, that was our final ever match that week or something like that. So he challenged AJ to come out. And instead, out came Frankie Kazarian dressed as AJ Styles, doing a tremendous impersonation of him, right down to the accent, the southern accent. This was hilarious. The people in the crowd were laughing. I don't know if they were supposed to be, but they were. This was great. This brought out Chavo and Hernandez, a couple of killjoys that they are. They had a match, went really, really long, like over 15 minutes long. And one spot during the match saw Hernandez hoist Daniels up for a standing vertical suplex. And I had to go back, I had to rewind this and watch it again, and this time I timed it with my stopwatch. Over 28 seconds he had this man up in the air for. Very impressive. And in the end, Chavo and Hernandez beat Daniels and Kazarian. Chavo gave Kazarian the frog splash. Kazarian seems to be the one who always takes the falls. Kazarian is like the loser of this team. I don't know why, but he took the fall. You know, why these guys aren't even tag team champions, I have no idea. But anyway, Chavo and Hernandez win. We had a segment on the show where the Aces and Eights tried to recruit Mr. Anderson as their new member, which just guarantees their destruction. I mean, if Anderson joins Aces and Eights, which I don't think he will, it just guarantees failure for them. But you know what? As far as I'm concerned, they can have the guy. You talk about a waste of space on this roster. I have no use for Mr. Anderson. Plus, when was the last time he even showed up on television before this week? It's been weeks and weeks. They don't have anything for the guy because there's nothing to do with the guy. So, whatever. Gail Kim beat Miss Tessmacher with Eat Defeat. Pretty good knockouts match. At one point, Gail rubbed her ass in Tessmacher's face. And then later, during her comeback, Tessmacher had Kim in the corner and rubbed her vagina in Gail's face. And these women clearly must have been trained by Bill DeMott. But anyway, while Tessmacher was rubbing said snatch in Gail's face, Tess screamed, "Happy New Year!" I don't know why I found this so funny, but I did. I laughed out loud. So, and I think Taz is coasting. I'm one of these people that just thinks, you know, I used to be a big Taz fan. I'm still a fan of his, but it's so clear. It's so obvious when you listen to this guy. He just doesn't give a fuck. He's just there to collect a paycheck. He could care less. He's just coasting along. But every now and then, there'll be a gem that comes from him, and this was one of those gems. So I laughed at that. The goddamn Jeff Hardy mind monologues were back on this show. I thought they had given up on that, but apparently not. Jeff was out in the crowd watching the main event between Austin Aries and Bobby Roode. And before one of the commercial breaks, they had a shot of Hardy, and we heard him speaking, even though his mouth wasn't moving, so damn it. Aries and Roode had a good match in the main event, though, heel versus heel, so the crowd didn't really have anybody to cheer for, but this was still pretty good. Both of them were going out of their way to use every heel trick in the book, every cheat, every shortcut you could possibly think of. And towards the end, Aries brought a chair into the ring, and Earl Hebner took it away from him and just freaked out on both guys. He said that, you know, they've broken every rule in the book. He was sick and tired of it. So, in a moment of solidarity, Aries and Roode both kicked Hebner in the gut and threw him out of the ring. And then they both spotted the steel chair laying on the mat. They dove for it simultaneously. They fought over the chair. Jeff Hardy's music played. Hardy came up from behind. He clotheslined Aries out of the ring. He gave Bobby Roode a twist of fate. Hardy was really favoring his lower back here. You know, sometimes Jeff Hardy moves around like he's 100 years old. And I don't know if he's just selling or not, but he looked old here. So, that's how Impact went off the air. Next week, they're back live. Sting makes his big return. They're also going to announce who the fans voted as the TNA Superstar of the Year. And Kurt Angle teams with Samoa Joe to take on D-Von and one of the masked jobbers from Aces and Eights in a steel cage match. So they're loading up for Bear with Impact. That's January 3rd. WWE loading up for Big Raw on January 7th. So they're bringing out the big guns, trying to pop a big number to start out 2013. So that's next week. Actually, that's this week. This Thursday is Live Impact. So let's get to mailbag questions and shout-outs. I have a whole bunch of them. As always, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com. That is the email address for that sort of thing. I want to mention a shout-out first. This comes from Joel, one of our longtime listeners, who actually wrote into me this morning. He was hoping for a wedding day shout-out for his fiance Libby and himself. They are getting married today at 3 o'clock, which means half an hour from now, in fact. They're going to be tying the knot as I am recording this. So, happy new year to Joel and Libby, and congratulations on your nuptials. That's very exciting. And the fact that on such a hectic day, as I'm sure it is, for him to think of me and the sound off is a really cool thing. So, congrats on that. Jack Garrity from Belfast, Northern Ireland writes in, I have not written in a while, but wanted to tell you how much I enjoy the show. I have not been able to catch Raw for a long time, but still never miss a sound off, and just hearing your reviews are good enough for me. I watched the TLC pay-per-view, and I'm jealous that you got to go there live. TLC has got to be the top pay-per-view of the year, outside of the Rumble and Mania. You tell it like it is, Solemn Monster, and in 3 years of listening, I honestly cannot think of many times I've disagreed with what you've said. Keep up the great work. P.S., I couldn't help but notice how many listeners from the great country of Northern Ireland you have for your show. For a country with as small a population as ours, it's really quite an anomaly. Perhaps we just have the best taste in entertainment. Great taste indeed. Thank you, Jack. Larry writes in, on this past Sound Off, you talked about Big E Langston and his finisher. Just to shed some light on Langston, he was a very over babyface on NXT, and his gimmick was one you often talk about, King Kong Bundy's five count. He would hit people with his finisher called the Big Ending and win the match and then proceed to do it again and demand a five count. While you said you hated his finisher, it is actually one of my favorites out of all the horrible new finishers like Sandow's Terminus. It is an over-the-shoulder cutter. Cutters, which generally focus on the head, is where Langston's finisher supposedly does its damage as well as the rib area. As I said, out of the new finishers, it is one of my favorites, only being surpassed by Rollins' curb stomp. Love the show and keep up the great work. All right, so it does damage to the ribs. That's what I wanted to know. I still think it looks dumb, but, you know, to each their own. Maybe when he starts doing it to other people, it'll look different to me. You know, it took me a while to warm up to Brock Lesnar's F5, but I did pretty quickly just because Lesnar would hurl his opponent through the air with such force. It just looked devastating whenever he would do it. This does not, but like I said, we'll see. Dylan from Louisiana, longtime listener. I get embarrassingly giddy when I notice a fresh episode available for download on my iPhone. Well, you're going to be especially giddy this week. You're going to get two. In your opinion, what does TNA need to do to get to that next level ratings-wise, popularity-wise, and financially? Seems like since their beginnings, they've hit every mark by hook or crook to climb the ladder of competition slowly but surely, with the only real major fumble, in my opinion, being the Monday Night Experiment. If the answer is more exposure via a second show, how would you personally structure that show? I do not think the answer is a second show. Absolutely, positively not. And if there were to be a second show, as far as structure, it should be an hour, not 2 hours. You know, I'm not sure there is any one or two things the company can do to boost ratings and get to what you call the next level. You know, as the product has improved creatively, which it has, and it has improved from where it was earlier this year. I mean, I wouldn't even watch Impact in January. I didn't start watching consistently until late May. But as they've improved in that regard, the ratings are actually down on average from last year. A year ago at this time, Impact averaged 1.6 million viewers. Okay, I looked this up. Now, the show averages a little under 1.3 million viewers. Average house show attendance a year ago was just under 1,000. 1,000 people per show. Now, it's 580 people per show. That's a significant drop. So, I think taking Impact on the road every week, not just more often, every week, and taking it out of the Impact zone is a good first step. You want more people to watch your TV program. You have to make it feel big time to these people. You know, TNA just does not feel big time to your average viewer. If you're a hardcore wrestling fan, it doesn't matter. You're going to watch it no matter what. But to the average viewer, I don't see TNA coming off as big league. Even with names like Hulk Hogan and Sting and Kurt Angle that people might recognize. Because they've brought every big name in under the sun. From Hogan to Flair to Sting to Steiner to Angle to Booker to Nash. And a bunch of other people I'm probably forgetting. And it hasn't meant anything. But like I said, you know, you want it to feel big time. And you know, in the Impact zone, TNA just, it won't. It can't. Not in such a small setting when everybody knows what WWE is and knows that WWE runs 15,000 seat arenas. Now, these days, WWE has their own problems trying to fill those arenas, but your average viewer doesn't know that. So that's a big first step. The next step is promotion. I think Spike TV has to do a better job of promoting TNA outside of just airing commercials on their own damn network. What good does it do? I mean, it's great that Spike TV is committed to Impact Wrestling and they air commercials for it. What good is it if they're airing commercials on their own friggin' network? I'm talking billboards. I'm talking a full-size ad blitz like they did back when they decided to move Impact to Monday nights against Raw. Impact did a big number that night for a number of reasons, but increased advertising was a big part of it. But to be honest, I think what TNA should do is not worry about ratings and focus on making their fans care enough to spend money on pay-per-view. I keep going back to that Samoa Joe Kurt Angle cage match from lockdown 5 or 6 years ago, which did something like 60,000 buys, which seems unfathomable today for a company that averages 7 or 8,000 per show. You know, come up with a compelling main storyline, no silliness, just a serious, believable feud. Aces and Eights does not count because Aces and Eights is not believable. Aces and Eights is bullshit. And they tried and it didn't work. Because now Aces and Eights has been relegated to a mid-card feud. You want evidence that Aces and Eights didn't work for all the idiots out there who hate it when I rag on Aces and Eights? And all the big reveal. Yeah, who knows what the big reveal will be. Maybe the big reveal will truly be a big reveal. We probably won't get it for another 3 or 4 months. But you know what the best evidence is that I'm right and you're wrong? That Aces and Eights has been a failure? The fact that Aces and Eights is now a mid-card angle. It is a mid-card feud. A mid-card storyline in TNA. The stuff with Kurt Angle and Wes Briscoe and Samoa Joe and these guys battling D-Von and Doc and all these, you know, the mass morons of Aces and Eights, that's no longer your main event feud. These guys that are supposedly hell-bent on the destruction of TNA for reasons that still have not been explained to us, by the way. You know, why they want the destruction of TNA when that means they'll be out of a job, they'll be out of work, boggles my mind. Why they want the destruction of TNA, they have not yet told us. But this is mid-card shit. Hulk Hogan and Bully Ray is your main storyline, not Aces and Eights. Now, maybe they wrap Aces and Eights around that at some point. Again, I still think Bully Ray, there's some connection there. But for now, that ain't going to work. You can't rely on that. So come up with, like I said, a serious, believable feud that people can get into, like Angle Joe all those years ago. You know, TNA took a page with that out of the UFC playbook with how they promoted that match. And I'm not saying TNA should become MMA, but it's okay to borrow elements from MMA that can be effective in pro wrestling. I think TNA could very easily do that. Right now, they're doing a better job of focusing on their own crop of guys like Bobby Roode, Austin Aries, Kazarian, Daniels, and having veterans like Bully Ray and RVD working with them. Hulk Hogan is good in his role, like I said, but he's featured way too much on the TV show. They need to cut back on that and do whatever it is they're going to do with the Aces and Eights stuff because, as I've said, that's just... it's not going to move the ratings needle. If that's what they're interested in, it's not going to work. Derek Fox, listener since episode 60. In your opinion, who is the greatest wrestler to never be a world champion? For me, it's a toss-up between William Regal and Dean Malenko. Regal had all the great in-ring skills, fantastic on the microphone. Malenko was amazing to watch in the ring, but when it came to promos, he was a tad bland. His matches with Mysterio and Jericho rank among some of the best I have ever seen. I would say Dean Malenko was a bit more than just a tad bland. That's being nice. Let's be honest here. He was a total bore on the microphone. But as a wrestler, he was awesome. I agree with you 100%. If you're talking the best wrestlers, like technically speaking, to never be a world champion, I mean, you know, there's far too many of them to count. When I think of the best wrestlers to never be, you know, say WWE champion, two names immediately spring to mind. Rowdy Piper and the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase. Neither of whom were outstanding wrestlers, per se, but, you know, they were both good enough wrestlers, don't get me wrong, but Piper was just such a goddamn great heel. Him as champion back during his peak would have been money. You could have printed money with Piper as a heel champion. I know why they didn't do it, because Hogan was their golden boy. You know, it's kind of like Ryback now. Ryback gets over. The last thing you should probably be doing is beating Ryback, but you're not going to interrupt CM Punk's title reign, so the timing is all wrong. I think it was a similar deal with Piper back then. Piper was great as the foil for Hulk Hogan, but I think he should have had a run as champion. By the time, you know, maybe they could have done it, he was a babyface. He wasn't, you know, the Roddy Piper of old. He wasn't wrestling full-time, whatever the excuse was, so it just didn't work out. Same with DiBiase, who was also very, very good. He was great, in fact, in his role. I think he would have made a great champion. He did get to defend the title at a few house shows in early 88 after Andre handed him the belt, but, I mean, that doesn't count. Kurt Hennig was a better worker than Piper or DiBiase were. He would have been good, too, but, I mean, he at least had a run as the AWA champion back when it still kind of meant something. But Piper and DiBiase would be the two names that spring to mind as far as I'm concerned. Matt Hardy from London, UK. No, not that Matt Hardy. Congrats on reaching the 250 show mark. I wanted to follow up on your comment 2 weeks ago regarding Kurt Angle. I totally agree with you. I went to a TNA after show party last January in London after the TV tapings, and though he only did a brief run-in at the end of the show, I was shocked and quite saddened when I saw Kurt in the bar after. He was nursing his neck with an ice pack, but he stood slightly hunched like an old man, like his body was wrecked. Just as sad was that he looked totally wired, like he was drugged up to the eyeballs for the pain. He was very pleasant, and I spoke to him briefly, but it was a downer for me to see him that way. I have no idea how he competes, and fear enough damage has been done already. Hey, I told the story before of when I went to the TNA show at Webster Hall here in New York City several years ago and got to meet Kurt. I met him at a private VIP signing before the show. You know, the price point for the ticket I bought happened to entitle, you know, me and my friend to VIP access. So I got to meet Kurt, got to, you know, take a picture with him. He was the TNA champion at the time. He was very nice. And I got to meet him again after the show. In the ring, they were doing that deal where you pay $20 or whatever and get in the ring. And I figured, why not? So I got to meet him a second time in the ring after the main event. He beat Christian back when he was Christian Cage. And he looked glassy-eyed. I mean, you know, you say he was wired. That's one word for it. I would describe him as glassy-eyed. You know, like the lights are on but nobody's home. That's the way that I would describe it. And it was really weird. And that was 2008. You're talking 2012. This was 4 years ago, and he looked like that. So I can believe it. I can absolutely believe it. Ravon Adamson writes in, my cousin Raquel's birthday was Christmas Day. Could she get a birthday shout-out? She listens to you when she comes to visit me from time to time. She says you have the best damn wrestling podcast, period. Why, thank you, Raquel. I appreciate that. Hope you had a great birthday and holiday. Do you think that if Triple H wasn't married to Stephanie McMahon, that he would be as successful as he is today? Well, obviously not, since he's going to be running the company soon. I doubt he would be running WWE if he wasn't married to the boss's daughter. As far as his 13 world titles are concerned, you know, same thing. I don't think he would have been quite as successful. I think he still would have held plenty of world titles. He would have been a main eventer, you know, especially because many of the other big stars, like Steve Austin and The Rock, namely, they left the company. And they would have wanted Hunter on top anyway. I mean, there was a point in time, and you could say they're still in that same situation even today, where they have a real lack of true main event stars. So I think for that reason alone, with all the guys that went down either with injuries or, you know, Rock went away, Austin retired, Triple H would have been the beneficiary of that anyway. He would have been prominently featured. But he largely headlined and won all those titles through the influence that he had sitting in all those production meetings and creative meetings. You know, one of the writers who worked for WWE, I can't remember who it was, but he, you know, he's done the rounds on some of the other podcasts, you know, the Torch and whatnot, and he's told this story before about one day he was being he was asked to go find Triple H backstage. This was at a Raw taping, and I think to give Triple H the script for that night's show or something, and Triple H was being a total dick to this guy, and Triple H looks it over, he flips through the script, and he just flips his shit over the fact that he's supposed to be doing a job that night. God only knows who he's supposed to be losing to. I don't know. But he is not happy with this. So either, I forgot, again, the parts of the story are a little cloudy, but either he ripped some pages out of the script or he went into his locker room and came back out. The point is, when Raw went on the air that night, Triple H miraculously, somehow, ended up not doing the job that he was scheduled to do. So you hear little stories like that from people on the inside who would know. And, you know, look, the guy is very talented, you know, and he does get a lot of unfair criticism because he's married to Stephanie McMahon. He would be a big star and a future Hall of Famer even without that, I feel. But would he be as successful as he's become without that connection? Absolutely not. And if you feel otherwise, you're being naive. Ravon also wants to know, has Bill Goldberg ever turned heel during his WCW run? The answer is yes, and it was a failure. You can thank Vince Russo for that. The heel turn, I think, came in the summer, I want to say, like mid-1999. Didn't last very long at all, which is probably why you don't remember it. And he went right back to being a babyface. Lastly, this comes from James. I've listened to episodes of the Sound Off since episode 10, and there is one issue I do not remember you discussing. What is the logic behind a wrestling company allowing an active member of the talent roster to book the product? Most notably, Kevin Nash was booking for WCW in 1998. We all know this. The question is why? One would think that the performer would simply book themselves to look strong, which allegedly happened in Nash's case, and would ultimately hurt the product. Have there been any other situations where a member of the talent roster has booked a company's television show? Yes. I mean, there have been other examples of wrestlers booking for the product while they themselves were on the active roster. Everyone remembers the whole Brian Pillman, I respect you, Booker man deal from his match with Kevin Sullivan in WCW. Sullivan was, you know, if he wasn't head booker, he certainly was assisting with the booking in WCW at that time. Even Ric Flair, While he was still wrestling, and I mean, really, when has Flair not been wrestling until now? But he was on the WCW booking committee at one time in the early 90s. I think Arn Anderson may have also possibly been a part of that booking committee as well. So there have been examples of it before, and I guess the logic is that these guys are people who know the business inside and out. They're veterans. They can contribute in a positive way creatively. You know, you would think instead of bringing in, for example, like these days, writers from TV and Hollywood and stuff like that, wouldn't we be better off having the wrestlers give their input? So that's kind of the logic behind it. That doesn't mean they will book themselves into strong positions at the expense of others, but I agree, a conflict of interest does exist, and it's probably not a wise idea if you are an active member of the roster. If you're retired, that's a different story. You know, somebody like Jake Roberts, for example, who seems to be doing very well these days. For those of you who aren't following along, he, you know, DDP, I give DDP a lot of credit. He really does deserve a lot of credit. He has helped Jake the Snake turn his life around. For how long? I don't know. You know, we've been through this before. We've heard this about Jake and Scott Hall, but it's been a couple of months now, and they're chronicling their adventures on YouTube. Diamond Dallas Page, I think that's his username on YouTube, Diamond Dallas Page, has his own YouTube channel. He uploads these videos for DDP TV of him and Jake. I mean, it's like the Odd Couple. You have to see these videos. And Jake seems to be doing very well for himself. He's been clean and sober now for a little while. That's the one thing that was holding him back all these years. He's expressed an interest before Jake has in working behind the scenes in WWE and contributing in a creative capacity. And, I mean, my God, somebody like Jake Roberts with his mind, you would think he would, I mean, he would potentially be a great fit creatively. It just hasn't worked out because of all the issues that he's had before. But, I think there are people who could probably contribute in a very positive way. They just probably should not be wrestling at the same time. I mean, I just got done talking about Triple H a few minutes ago. And while he was never the booker, per se, he certainly sat in on those production meetings and had a say in the direction of not only his character, but other characters as well. And I think the question was always, why does Triple H have to be in on these meetings? Why does he have to have a say in other people's business and their matches? And we're talking early 2000s here when this was going on. There's another famous story which has been told about Triple H being in on a meeting, and Gerald Briscoe was there and a bunch of other people, and they were talking about putting the title on Kurt Angle. This probably was right before Kurt got the belt in 2000 when he beat The Rock, and Triple H, for some reason, was in on this meeting. God only knows why. And he was against it. And his argument for being against it was, well, Kurt's too small. People wouldn't believe it. He's a small guy. And you know, as the story goes, Gerald Briscoe piped up. Somebody actually showed some balls, which is unusual for these types of meetings. But Briscoe spoke up and said something to the effect of, well, you know, why don't we get you two guys together for a shoot and we'll see who's the tougher guy. And I think Triple H quieted down after that. But why would Triple H even feel compelled to interject in something like that? You know, this is some other guy's push. This is some other guy's career that we're talking about here. And I could easily believe that happened. So again, it's a valid question. You know, who knows whose potential pushes may have been squashed as a result of him being in on those meetings all these years. You know, we'll never know. So that's going to do it for the mailbag here, episode 252. We're going to wrap this up. If you have questions, shout-outs, comments, suggestions, anything like that, thesolomonster@gmail.com is the email address, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @solomonster. I'm always live tweeting at events and stuff like that. It's always fun times on there. And anytime a new, you know, vintage show goes up on YouTube or anything like that, Twitter is usually the first place I mention that. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster. Send me a friend request. I want to be your friend on Facebook. That sounded creepy. I'm sorry. But you can send me a friend request on there. That's the official profile page for yours truly and the show. We have live threads going on Monday night for Raw, the pay-per-views, all that stuff. And subscribe to the show on iTunes, youtube.com. I don't know what the URL is. I know my username on there is The Solomonster, all one word. Again, subscribe there because that's where the vintage episodes are going up, the lost episodes from yesteryear. There's two new ones up. There'll be another one going up on New Year's Day this Tuesday, so that'll be a YouTube exclusive. And you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Type in Solomonster Sounds Off. You can subscribe in there. It doesn't cost you a thing. Leave some feedback if you have a few moments. I always appreciate that. And I think that wraps up. We have a group on Facebook as well. I always forget to promote the group. But there is an official Solomonster Sounds Off Facebook group for those of you who want to talk wrestling with some of your fellow Sound Off listeners. So you can type that in. You have to send a request for membership. I will approve you. And I think that pretty much covers everything. So, again, I will be working on another episode of the Sound Off later today. It will go up tomorrow. That's New Year's Eve, December 31st. That is the plan. If plans change, you can follow me on Twitter. I'll keep everybody posted. But that'll be episode 253. We'll have a year-in-review look at WWE and TNA and some predictions for 2013. Plus, I may have some more mailbag questions as well that I do on that show. I'm not sure yet, but that is the plan, and you can check out episode number 6 of The Sound Off. That'll be going up on YouTube on Tuesday. So until next time, be well, stay safe. I want to wish everybody out there a happy new year. Thank you for your support this year. 2012 has been our best year yet, and I'm sure 2013 will be even bigger. So keep spreading the word to your friends and family members and colleagues and enemies and anybody else you could think of. But I want to wish everybody out there a happy new year. Have a safe new year, however you may be celebrating. And we'll be back with the Year in Review Special, episode 253, coming up tomorrow. And, of course, next weekend we'll be back with another brand new episode. So, until next time, take care, happy new year, and we'll see you right back here next time.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster sounds off on scoops.com.